let's talk about is recorded and produced in Treaty 1 territories, on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Thank you very much for listening. Kind of sitting here and vibing to this music. Hello and welcome to Let's Talk About. I'm Jason, and this episode is one that I've been wanting to do for a very, very long time. It's a topic that when I first came up with this show was something that I wanted to talk about, and it kind of fell by the wayside. A lot of things happened. And it's kind of, it's a can that I've been kicking down the road for a very long time. But at this point I've talked about a lot of pieces that come with like a lot of pieces that come together with this topic to kind of promote a healthy society and a just society, in a lot of ways, and a progressive society. So this episode, I want to talk about harm reduction policies. And harm reduction is an approach, and I'm specifically, harm reduction cuts across a lot of different areas and phenomena in our society. It touches homelessness and domestic violence. And what I want to talk primarily about, and a lot where a lot of the research into harm reduction and a lot of the use of harm reduction has been very successful is in drug use and drug abuse. This whole episode was spawned from a conversation that I had this past weekend. Like many episodes, I was speaking with a friend of mine who their parent is a teacher here in Manitoba. And they're from a community that has very, very, very high drug use and drug addiction. Right now, here in Manitoba, we are going through an ongoing opioid crisis. Meth use has exploded, and it still remains very high. It's actually gotten a lot worse during the COVID pandemic because of kind of the poverty and the despair and all of the other things that COVID brought with it. Not just the you know, the deaths due to COVID and the infections due to COVID and all of the upheaval. But it has really exacerbated and exposed a lot of issues that have been there for a very long time. And a lot of us have been talking about for a very long time, but we're not given the attention that they needed. And one of those is the opioid crisis and drug addiction. So back to the story, my friend, her mom works in a school, is a teacher, and is a science and a health teacher. And part of the curriculum or a part of the policy from the school was to impose harm reduction as part of the curriculum. So this is a community where people do a lot of people do drugs, young people specifically do drugs, and they want to prevent people from dying. So they thought harm reduction approach. We are going to teach these kids about, we're not going to hide it. We're not going to just moralize to them and tell them that drug use is wrong. We're going to tell them, we're going to teach them about drugs and about the harms of drugs, but also like safely using these drugs. And they have potentially, you know, they've shown they've actually saved quite a few lives because people were able to understand how to do things safely, how to test things, how to what signs to look out for when someone's like overdosing, and they've been able to actually save quite a few lives. But harm reduction as generally, and this whole thing is going to be talking about it in the context of drugs and drug substance use and abuse, is all aimed at not explicitly stopping the behavior. So you accept the reality that a behavior will occur, that things like prohibition will not stop it. You accept that a behavior will occur. People will do drugs. If somebody wants to do something, they will do something. Eventually, it will happen. So, in the context of substance use, people will do drugs eventually. People will continue to need to do drugs for whatever maladaptive reason. So maladaptive meaning they have taken in this behavior and they conduct this behavior because it helps them adapt to a negative, it's a harmful activity that helps them, that allows them to adapt and deal with another harmful activity or existence, a harmful problem. So it's harming themselves to cover up a harm, essentially. So with this, one of what harm reduction aims to do is accept that reality that this behavior will occur and ensure that you that the person can do it safely. So it's a commitment to the evidence, which is that it's safe and cost effective, that it avoids stigma, and the goal is to keep, specifically in the context of drugs, is to keep people alive and encourage positive change in their lives, and then reduce the harms of drug laws and policy, and offer alternatives to approaches that seek to prevent or end drug use. And one of the best ways to explain this is through safe injection sites, and I'm thinking specifically in Vancouver, where they saw very high use of intravenous drugs like heroin and a lot of deaths. They were having a lot of overdoses in Vancouver, specifically in specific areas of Vancouver, and they introduced safe injection sites. And we've had conversations about having safe injection sites and safe consumption. Now it's now moved to safe consumption because the definition's expanded beyond intravenous drug use. So there's things like here in Manitoba, we've got meth, alcohol. In other communities, there's cocaine, crack cocaine, all of these other different drugs. So safe consumption sites is kind of the more proper name, but we're going to be going through a study that talks about safe injection sites. But what they found in Vancouver was that primarily overdose deaths and HIV infections dropped when they imposed or they introduced safe injection sites. So a safe injection site is a place where accepting the fact that somebody will do, if somebody wants to do drugs, they will do drugs. If someone's addicted to drugs, they will use them. Accept that reality and they can go to this site where they'll be able to get a clean needle. They'll be able to test the drugs that they have to see if there's anything harmful within them, anything that's not supposed to be there, and then consume that drug with specially trained doctors and nurses right there to help them if something were to go wrong. And what the evidence supports is that this approach is actually working to reduce deaths, and it's helping channel people into drug treatment. You can't treat somebody if they are dead, more or less. And to give, to take away that barrier of stigma and to have somebody who's there and understands that they can trust really does wonders to channel people towards addictions counseling. So first off, let's look
kind of holistically at this. So really, there are four main pillars to treating kind of this epidemic of drug use that our country is facing. So there's prevention at the really going upstream and solving the underlying issues that cause substance use and abuse in the first place. Things like poverty, intergenerational trauma from residential schools, family histories of abuse, things like that. Solving those problems before they can manifest themselves in maladaptive behaviors like substance abuse. Barring that, if that fails, you have harm reduction, which is this behavior has not been prevented, it has started, so let's help them do this in the safest way possible so they can continue on living as healthy as they possibly can while they are doing this behavior. From there, you have enforcement, which is changing laws and policy around substances in order to promote a positive changes in life. So taking away things like in the war on drugs, we've had crazy mandatory minimums. You go to prison, you have a little bit of a drug on you, you go to prison, and your life is essentially over. You're inundated, you're stuck with a bunch of hardcore criminals. You come out, it's hard for you to get a job, it's hard for you to rent a place, it's hard for you to get your life back on track, and thus you fall back into the behaviors you were doing before that got you in trouble in the first place, and the cycle just continues. So once you've got proper enforcement, you can move towards treatment, which is actually providing mental health and physical health and addictions treatment to help people, get their lives back on track to continue to use that phrase. But what we're going to talk about here are those two middle pillars because they're a little bit related. So the first being harm reduction. Now, I've got a study here actually where they have looked at safe injection sites. So this is a study, 2017 study coming out of the University of Alberta in Edmonton. So the principal author is Jennifer Eng from the University of Alberta, but also Dr. Christy Sutherland and Dr. Michael R. Kolber. Sutherland is from Vancouver, working at the medical director of the Portland Hotel Society, and Dr. Kolber is the associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Alberta. So University of Alberta and Vancouver. So their whole question was, and the title of the article is, does evidence support supervised injection sites? So SISs, supervised injection sites, safe injection sites, safe consumption sites, or more or less interchangeable. This is specifically looking at supervised injection sites, which I talked about, which exist in Vancouver, where a user can go get a clean needle, test their drugs, and use under the supervision of a nurse or a doctor. So the clinical question here was, do supervised injection site SISs reduce mortality, hospitalizations, ambulance calls, or disease transmission? And the bottom line, what they found is that based on the evidence, cohort and modeling studies, SISs are associated with lower overdose mortality, fewer ambulance calls for treating overdoses, and a decrease in HIV infections. Their effects on hospitalizations are still murky and unknown at this point, but let's go through the evidence a little bit more here. So a cohort study examined overdose mortality before and after an SIS opened in Vancouver. This is one of the ones I'm talking about. Of the people living within 500 meters of the SIS, and this accounts for 70% of the SIS's users, came from people who lived within 500 meters of it. Overdose deaths decreased from 253 to 165 per 100,000 person years. I'm not sure exactly what that metric means, but 253 down to 165. So that is a difference of 88 deaths, 88 fewer deaths, which accounts for one overdose death prevented every year for every 1,137 users of the SIS. and that is a decrease. So it actually drops it. And there's actually no change in mortality in the rest of the city. So while within 500 meters of this SIS, where most of the people were coming from, everywhere else in the city, mortality stayed the same or rose. But for the people around it, the people who are easily able to access the SIS, because the closer you are, the more frequently you're going to be able to use it. If you're going trucking halfway across Vancouver to use this SIS, you're not going to be using it very often. But if you're really close, you're going to use it. So people who are living close to an SIS saw mortality drop. They were living longer. They were not having as many overdose deaths. While the rest of Vancouver, it stayed the same or rose. Now let's talk about hospitalizations. Hospitalizations were was a little bit murky. So one of the interesting findings from this, the rest of the findings were kind of mixed. They weren't really able to associate any correlation. But an interesting piece that I found is that while SIS nurse referral to a hospital increased the likelihood of admission, the average length of the stay decreased by 8 days from on an average of 12 days to 4 days. So when a nurse at an SIS would refer somebody to a hospital and send them to a hospital for whatever they were, whatever issue they were seeing, if it was a rash or potential overdose symptoms or something else, the referral actually increased the likelihood of admission. And this ties back to something that we see in here in Winnipeg, but kind of across the country in general, is that drug users are stigmatized, obviously, but they are not trusted and not held as credible at hospitals. So hospital admissions for drug users is very low because there's a fear that they're faking it, or they're just experiencing a high, so they're not actually experiencing these symptoms that they're experiencing. So they're just sent on their way. But the referral, having one nurse tell another nurse there's something here, increased it. So it doesn't point to like exactly anything. It does point to a benefit, but it more points to the fact that we need to start listening to drug users when they say that there's a problem. But the interesting piece is that along with that, the average length of the stay decreased by 8 days. So having a nurse there who's trained in, you know, in operating and trained in people who are, you know, understanding people who are using drugs and this the diseases and conditions that can come along with that, they're able to give proper information and more accurate information and a more accurate diagnosis to whoever whoever's working at the hospital they're sending them to, so they get more effective treatment. And also they're able to catch things a lot earlier than they would if the user was doing it on their own. Usually, you know, think about when you have a medical issue that would have to take you to the hospital. You usually don't think about it until it becomes such an issue that you have to go to the hospital. And that actually increases the length of time that you'll have to be there, because the issue has already gotten to an advanced stage where it is causing real, you know, it has been able to cause real damage. So by looking at these and catching these things early, they were able to reduce the average length of a stay at a hospital. Near one of the SISs, the average monthly ambulance calls with naloxone treatment for a suspected opioid overdose decreased from 27 to 9. So that's a 67% reduction in calls. So went from 27 calls for naloxone for an ambulance down to 9. And naloxone is basically an antidote for overdose. And here's the last one. About 6 to 57 HIV infections per year are prevented by the SIS, according to mathematical modeling. Now, there's mathematical modeling, and there's, obviously things like infections and disease spread are very complicated. So in a lab versus in reality, it's a little bit different, and I've talked about this on the show before. But their modeling suggests that up to 57 HIV infections per year are prevented by an SIS, so a place where people can safely consume or use clean needles to use their intravenous drugs. It's actually an amazing find. So by reducing the harm, by having these sites, you're able to, you know, you're not going to be able to stop these people. You're accepting the reality that they're going to use these drugs. Just let them do it safely. Just do it safely and we'll figure it out after the fact. We can't help you if we can't treat you if you're dead. So just be safe. And we're finding that it's, you know, people are living, there's fewer overdose deaths, there's fewer infections of HIV, there's fewer, people are dying a lot less. So that's kind of what a harm reduction model can do. You look and say, this behavior will happen. We accept the reality that this behavior will happen, even if we prohibit it. You get a life sentence in prison if you have like a speck of methamphetamine on your clothes. You go to prison forever. That the deterrence does not work. It does not work in these cases. Deterrence in and of itself is not a great way to stop crime from happening. But then harm reduction is nothing without proper enforcement. And when I mean proper enforcement, I mean enforcement aimed at reducing harm and preserving and allowing for positive change for people who are abusing substances and using substances. And the perfect example of this is Portugal. So Portugal famously decriminalized all drugs starting in 2001. And have seen amazing progress in the years since. So in 2001, they actually hit a peak. It was very close in terms of drug deaths per 100 per capita. It was very close to the EU average at the time. But right after that, while the numbers in the EU cruised up, continuing on, rising basically across the region, across the continent, overdose deaths dropped precipitously in Portugal right after decriminalization, leading to about in 2005 and then in 2011, there was almost reached zero deaths per capita in overdose deaths per capita in Portugal, which is an insane number. It is insane. If you want the hard numbers, since the rates remain some of the lowest in the EU in Portugal. So there's 6 deaths per million according among people 15 to 64. 6 per million people. And the EU average is 23.7 per million. This was in 2019. Obviously, opioid deaths are climbing again, or overdose deaths are climbing again for a variety of reasons. But that is a staggering, staggering number. That is nearly a quarter the average of the EU is Portugal. That is incredible. Another comparison that is absolutely staggering. In Scotland, in the same period, in 2019, there were 315 deaths. 315. The EU average is 23.7. In Scotland, it was 315 per million in that 15 to 64 age range, which is 50 times higher than Portugal's rates. One where drugs are prohibited, the other one where they're decriminalized, which is, and it has proper harm reduction included in there. So Portugal before decriminalization, over 40% of prisoners in Portuguese prisons were sentenced for drug offenses. After decriminalization, that has dropped all the way down around up to 2019, where it was roughly 15%. Went from over 40% down to 15%, while the EU kind of median has stayed relatively the same, but has grown. And Portugal's percentage of their prison population for that is there for drug offenses is lower than the EU average. And in fact, what they're finding is you would think that with decriminalization, everyone's just going to start doing drugs because they're decriminalized. The opposite is actually true in Portugal. Portugal has, as of, this was numbers as of 2020, Portugal has the fourth lowest percentage of people using any illegal drugs in Europe. The fourth lowest. The highest is France at the far end. The only countries lower than Portugal are Romania, Greece, and Turkey. Turkey has the lowest. So the UK, Belgium, Germany, Italy, Spain, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, all are have higher drug use than Portugal, which has decriminalization. So decriminalization was met with a change in the approach to drug education, moving away from abstinence-based kind of just say no campaign. Their drug use in school children has been below the European average, and rates in 2019 were roughly the same as 2001. So this, they're seeing a much lower average than Europe following this this decriminalization, which is going on its 21st year. Finally, we can't escape without talking about HIV infections, which also have seen an extreme drop. So starting in 2001, there was roughly 501 new HIV diagnoses attributed to injecting drug use. That has fallen to 13, 501 in 2001, down to 13 in 2019. Staggering. Now, this is not just a function of decriminalization, and I'm talking about this in the context of enforcement and how enforcement supports harm reduction. Decriminalization was met with with concerted use of prevention and harm reduction. So harm reduction programs meant to, if people are using drugs, do them as safely as possible. We've seen this massive, staggering drop in HIV infections, the staggering drop in drug use, the staggering drop in criminalization, and this staggering drop in overdose deaths. And because it wasn't just you decriminalize drugs and you leave it alone, you prevent, you go upstream and you say, okay, what are the things that lead people to using drugs? Okay, let's solve those problems as well. Let's address those problems as well. It is not just and this goes for a lot of things like homelessness, domestic violence, crime in general. You need a holistic approach if you are going to solve any of these issues. If you want to stop people from doing drugs, you can't stop them from, if you don't want people to do drugs, prevent the thing that caused them to do drugs in the first place. Go all the way back. What is the underlying cause here? And it's not availability of drugs. It's not a personal failing. It is something else that you can solve. So using this holistic approach, combining harm reduction with harm prevention and proper enforcement and proper treatment as well, all come together to create a safer, healthier society where people do not need to use and abuse these substances and do not have to deal with the situations that they are put in all the time. All right, that will do it for me today. Thank you very, very much for listening. This has been Let's Talk About, talking about harm reduction enforcement. If you're listening live on 101.5 UM FM, thank you very much for listening. Keep the dial on 101.5. Got great songs, great shows coming up right after this one. If you're listening on Spotify, thank you very, very much for your download. As always, thank you very much for listening, and have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay safe, everybody.